Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So a funny thing happened this week. BBC posted a link on Twitter to an old bit of footage of Jim Steinman, who sadly died this week. And who's interviewing him but me? And I have no memory of it whatsoever.
I saw it and you look impossibly youthful.
I did, didn't
I? I mean, how old were you? 30? No.
30. I think I was 30.
You really look so young.
1981.
But can you not remember? I've got some. There are times I see clips occasionally. I can't remember doing them at all. So you can't remember talking to him?
I can't really. No. I'm fully prepared to accept the documentary evidence in the film. That's me. You know, that nobody faked it.
No, that's indisputable.
I don't actually remember it. So anyway, so he died at the age of 73. He'd been ill for a few years, hadn't he?
Yeah,
he had a stroke 4 years ago. So he'd obviously
really interesting
been bloke, ailing.
Though. Interesting. It's interesting reading about him. You know, I like the idea that very early on he didn't see the point in writing about ordinary real life stuff. No. He thought he was going to write about vampires and fast cars and motorbikes and fallen heroes and all that. And even at college, he wrote an entire musical, didn't he? The book, the lyrics, the music, the production, the whole thing. He wanted to make albums that sounded like movies. That's quite
well,
he came at it
via musical theatre, didn't he? Really?
Yeah, he did.
I mean, he came at it like Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. It was that kind of angle. And he was working with Joseph Papp, the American impresario, puts on Shakespeare in the Park in Central Park, did for years, who identified him as a kind of coming talent. And that's where he met Meatloaf.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Meatloaf, similarly, was a kind of a stage performer, wasn't he, rather than a rock and roller, you know. And
precisely. They worked on a National Lampoon project, didn't they, I think? Weren't they both on that at the same time?
They could well have done it. Then Meatloaf is involved in Rocky Horror Picture Show, but you know they were all about treading the boards, the pair of them. You know, that was their kind of background, and he developed all those songs. That's the interesting thing to me. He developed all those songs for Meatloaf. You know that Meatloaf was the natural performer for those kind of songs, even though people around him said, no, you got to drop the fat guy and get somebody. Get
but isn't that, you see, that's really interesting. Hunky. Isn't that the root of the legal wrangles, the financial wrangles that they had later? It's really interesting. If you have that amount of money, that amount of profit, there's always going to be disagreement about who got their fair share because there's awesome. So much of it available.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a really interesting story because Jim Steinman, they both sued each other. You know, Jim Steinman.
It's very complicated because Meatloaf always claimed he never sued Jim Steinman. He always says, my manager sued his manager. I think it's a really, really complicated story. But what was undoubtedly the case was that Meatloaf had some part in coming up with the ideas for a lot of those songs.
He did, and claimed to have contributed to the lyrics as well. So it gets really complicated.
Sure he would have done.
At the most basic argument is that Jim Steinman wrote those songs, as you say, for Meatloaf to perform. So without those songs, there couldn't have been any hits and there couldn't have been any great profit. But Meatloaf's argument was that without Meatloaf performing them, it was Meatloaf's version of those songs that made them hits. And had he not been the person doing it, then A, they wouldn't have been written in the first place because they were written for Meatloaf, and B, it was Meatloaf that made them successful. So you can see what an incredibly complicated tussle that is.
Oh, it is. Well, and it's undoubtedly the case. You get a thing like this, where you sell a load of records. The person who writes them makes four times as much money, if not more than that, you know. And it just keeps going forever.
But I interviewed Meatloaf in about 83. Do you remember for Smash Hits?
Oh, I certainly do.
And I think it was about 1983. And even then, he claimed that he had received very little money. I don't think he'd sued anybody, but he claimed he had received very little money. and that the managers and the agents and whatever, the label had taken most of it. And he was living in quite a modest house in upstate New York. It wasn't a very flashy place. Little patch of land and a little lawnmower and his wife and his three kids. And during that interview, a messenger arrived from one of the attorneys with a writ, which he claimed was claiming back some of the royalties that had been paid to him that he then had to pay back. I think he claimed it was for Steinman. But I didn't get the impression he made a lot of money in the first place, actually. So I've no idea. By the end, he must have done, because there was so much. There was Bad LFL 2 and Bad LFL 3 as well.
I think what happens with these things, though, if you know, where there's a hit, there's a writ.
Yeah.
And so if something makes a fortune, it's immediately legally challenged, and therefore it's locked up. It's frozen in some way. So whatever money you earn, you might not make for years. It might not actually come through for years, you know, during which time everybody expects you to be living like a millionaire. So it was obviously a very fraught story, although it didn't stop them getting back together, did it, for many years later for Bat Out of Hell 2.
They did. No, they did.
Bat Out of Hell 3, I think.
Yeah.
And then there was the musical, which was, you know, it was launched in the UK and did quite well, I think. And was supposed to be launched in the United States, but then I think COVID intervened, and, you know, whether it will in the fullness of time happen, I don't know. I tell you what's interesting to me, little detail, that they shopped around Bat Out of Hell to every record company.
And nobody wanted to know.
Nobody wanted to know. Apart from Cleveland International, who were a small record company that happened to have a deal with CBS for distribution. And they were best known for poker music, which is just absolutely... And when I always think about poker music, I always think of John Candy. You know, that there's some film where John Candy... was it in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I think, where they end in the back of a van with a load of poker musicians.
Yeah.
It's always got a reputation as being the corniest form of music, but there is a market for it in the middle of the United States for poker music, for people who trace their origins back to, you know, the Czechoslovakia or whatever. But it was Cleveland International who signed him and did very, very well out of it. And of course, our late colleague, Mike Appleton, who was one of the people responsible for making it happen.
Oh, he was, because that was one of those rare moments when the whistle test kind of made it, didn't it?
Absolutely. He was the guy who said, I want to, you know, he saw this video of, what's the name of the woman he sings with? I can't remember.
Oh, I can't remember.
Colored. I can't remember.
Yeah, but he saw it and he showed it. All I remember, it was in. There were so many calls saying this is fantastic. They showed it the next week, and then I think he came over and did an interview, and it just took off.
Well, he did. I think it took off in the UK before it.
Yeah.
Before it did. You know, it went back to the United States.
It did. So, but Steinman, I was reading some things about Steinman. He obviously just was eaten up by this idea that he'd been so unsuccessful for ages. He just wanted to remind people that he'd made it and that he'd succeeded. And there's a bit where he goes for an interview with somebody in 1996 in a French restaurant, and he ordered everything on the menu. He said, I'm going to taste everything. And he ordered every single thing on the menu, paid a bill of $800, which is the sort of thing you can do if you're absurdly wealthy.
Yeah.
So very odd guy, and lived, I think, in the rest of his life, lived on his own in some big high security house, and just quite happy with his own company, but obviously quite eccentric and bonkers, you know.
Yeah.
But I tell you the thing it made me think of slightly, actually, at a tangent, was the Bay City Roller story. Because last week, very sad, you know, Les McCann died. And, you know, the Rollers is another story about an enormous profit that somehow just disappears, and that the people who expect to get some of it and probably deserve to get it's a fair amount of it don't. You know, they were put together, weren't they, by Tam Payton, son of a potato merchant, where it was. And they had they had huge hits, the Rollers. They had 10 top 10 hits in this country. They had hits all over the world. The amount of money it must have generated. Phil Coulter and Bill Martin, I think, wrote most of the songs. One of their hits was written by two members of the band. But otherwise, I mean, a huge amount of money. Mm. And in 1979, they were pretty much penniless. They sued for their royalties. They had to give up because they couldn't afford the case. They ran out of money to pay their lawyers, and each of them settled for £30,000. Les had moved his parents out of their council house and into a house, and then had to move them back into the council house.
Yes.
Heartbreaking. I mean, absolutely heartbreaking stuff.
Mm.
So, I mean, is it possible that they could have genuinely earned that little? They just got a very bad deal. If you don't write the songs, all you're getting is the PRS.
If you don't go,
I suppose it's possible that you don't make very much, but it does seem incredibly.
Well, and also, I think in those days, bands made far less than they would make now, you know, because live, you know, being paid for live wouldn't be anything like as lucrative as it is now.
Yeah.
And it's possible that every single expense they incurred got deducted from what they earned.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that tends to happen, you know, as we discussed in the past, the small faces, you know, people can live large while working like hell, not realizing that living large is costing them a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, but who knows?
I was thinking about that as the comparison with the humble pie and the small face. I was thinking about other bands that have been monstrously ripped off. But I mean, but also I felt quite fondly about the Rollers. The Guardian writer, Caroline Sullivan, wrote a book about being obsessed with the Rollers. She's actually very, very good. There's a lovely bit in it. Yeah. And it's one of the first, because they were the biggest fan mania sensation since the Beatles, which we would forget, don't we? Mm-hmm. Hadn't been anything like it. And she wrote this book called Bye Bye Baby, My Tragic Love Affair with the Bay City Rollers. And she was quite old when she got interested. She was 17 when she got interested. She never wore the tartan, you know. But she said, I can remember there's a bit in the book which I read about what the feeling was like when there were so many of you running down the streets that you stopped the traffic, that you closed streets and the police couldn't control you, and how incredibly thrilling that was. That was quite interesting, really.
I've always felt the core of teenage girls' hysteria is nothing to do with the group at all. It's just to do with feeling the power.
I think it is.
It's
absolutely
just to do with, let's fill this room with noise. You know? Let's stop the traffic.
Let's stop the traffic.
It doesn't matter whether it's Bay City Rollers, the Beatles,
or whoever.
Yeah.
It gives you some kind of power and control.
Absolutely.
Really, very exciting.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So 45 years ago this week, the Ramones' first album, 45 years ago.
What a photo on the front too.
It's an absolutely brilliant image.
Which they paid $125 for that. That was money well spent, wasn't it?
Really? Is that the basis of their logo? Actually, Were we talking the other day about the fact that you can now get a Ramones T-shirt from
Marks and Sparks?
Marks and Spencers.
Marks and Spencers. We were trying to work out whether Marks and Spencers had paid anything for the right to do that.
The Ramones logo, it's like the Rolling Stones logo. It's probably the most valuable asset of the group. And so it's just a thing you keep publishing, isn't it? And you make money out of it whichever way you can. Anyway, the thing that struck me about this, 45 years ago, and I remember I was working in a record shop when this came out, import copies. Oh, there they are. We looked at the cover, we'd heard of them. That's funny in itself, isn't it?
It's funny. You know,
that's kind of four guys. They're all wearing leather jackets, and look, his T-shirt's too short. And
they're in uniform.
They've all got sneakers. They're completely in uniform. They're called the Ramones. That's kind of funny as well.
They've got the same name.
And then we played it. And I remember everybody laughed. Now, I don't mean that they laughed derisively or anything like that. You know, you played at the shop, and a load of customers in the shop. It was an average afternoon. And people just looked up. Because first track starts 1, 2, 3, 4, here it goes like that, and then it stopped. What seemed in a way that seemed extremely abrupt, and then there was a bit of silence. Then you heard 1, 2, 3, 4, and off it went again, and it's five songs
under 2 minutes long.
They're slightly longer. I was just looking. They're 212, 230.
They're under 2 minutes.
Judy's Bank, 130. Chainsaw, 155. Yeah, quite a few are under
130. A song that's 130 long. He's a mate, 1976. It's incredible.
So, but people thought it was funny. You know, they were. the idea of it was funny. It was like a piece of conceptual art.
Yeah.
And it really struck me as quite significant, this, because not far off, round about the same time, there was another record which proved to be highly influential, similarly influential, which was similarly regarded as a bit of a novelty comedy record, and that was Kraftwerk's Autobahn.
Absolutely.
You know, they thought...
But they're quite similar, don't you think? Because with the Ramones, it didn't seem to me to be that important that you knew which one was which. They seemed to be interchangeable. I felt the same with Kraftwerk. Yeah. With Kraftwerk, I thought, well, and that was the point. They were meant to be these robots, these automatons, these machines, these holograms or whatever. You know, it didn't really matter. I don't remember ever really learning the names of any members of Kraftwerk or what instrument they played, because that didn't seem obvious either. It wasn't like, he's the drummer, he's the bass player, like rock and roll, you know. And I felt they were very similar. I agree with you. They were kind of little cartoons. And also uniform. There was a sense of uniform, but they looked the same on stage, you know.
With Autobahn, it was, you know, the single was out there. And then people said, do you know what? They've made an album. What? Really? Yeah, it's an album. And it's also called Autobahn. And it goes on longer. And they thought, wow, that is a really wacky conceptual joke. And then later on, they've made another album. You know what I mean? It was coming at you in a totally different way.
Yeah, completely.
And that's probably what made it so revolutionary.
Anyway, I remember finding it hard to process that they didn't have a rhythm section actually at the time, which makes me sound really, really old-fashioned, which I guess I am.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people thought, well, hang on, what? Because you're used to orientating. You had to orientate yourself around the way groups looked, and he does that, and she does that, and, you know.
Yeah.
And I felt a bit lost. But there was just a lovely thing Danny Baker tweeted. I'm sure you saw it, and he was saying that I think it was Tommy Ramone had said that Blitzkrieg, you know, the Hey Ho, Let's Go chant was inspired by Saturday Night by the Bay City Rollers. And if you listen to Saturday Night by the Bay City Rollers, it's exactly the same, which came out, I think, the year before, actually, 74, 75. Uh-huh. And so Danny's whole thing is you know, okay, so if the Bay City Rollers were the inspiration for the Ramones, then, you know, without the Rollers, no punk rock, which I think is fair. He's probably pitching it a bit high, but it's quite funny though.
No, well, it's like without all of rock and roll history, no punk rock, because it was all just completely based on stuff that had gone before, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know? Well, absolutely.
There's always a certain sector of the population whose attention you can only get if you say, without this, no punk rock. Yeah. Just to go, oh, my God.
Hang on, that's the thing I like and feel strongly
that's
about.
Serious.
You know, yeah.
I don't care about disco music.
Yeah, but punk rock is the foundation. My whole world has been overthrown.
Absolutely.
This is terrible.
So 45 years ago.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? Absolutely, absolutely
extraordinary. Amazing.
So what have we been doing this week? We've spoken to...
We talked to Richard Thompson.
We talked to Richard Thompson about his book, Bee's Wing, and that'll be with you soon. We talked earlier in the week to Ricky Lee Jones about her book, Last Chance Texaco, which will be with you soon. Two books with something in common, I think you were thinking, Mark.
Well, I was, because they're both about the early years, and they both end at the point where the authors have had their greatest success. Ricky Lee Jones, I think, ends about 2 or 3 years after kind of Chucky's In Love and the first album and the breakthrough. And Richard Thompson's record ends in... trying to think what year it was now, 83, I don't know. I think he's still got something like 14 albums to come, you know. And you think, that's really interesting. You know, memoirs that concentrate only on the liftoff. I thought that was quite interesting because, you know, most memoirs, you read them, and they have the same kind of, they have the same rhythm, don't they? All that excitement and all that, it's all new and it's all groundbreaking and, you know, they're young and they're seeing everything through fresh eyes for the first time. And then after that, it does become repetitive and it starts to kind of flatten out, doesn't it? It's a series of solo albums and it's a tour and it's a reunion, you know. And I really like the idea of both those books, actually, rightly or wrongly, that you're left on a real high. You're not left at that point where now I look back over my life. It's you're left at the moment when they've had their most success, you know, and it's the most exciting. No, that's not true. It's not the biggest commercial success, but it's the most exciting creative period, almost definitely, of their life.
But it's also the period that is most incident packed, isn't it?
Yeah, because it is.
It's the most hectic period.
Yeah.
Because also things used to move more quickly, as we frequently remarked, whereas when people get into middle age and beyond and so forth, it's one record every 18 months or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it just proceeds at a different pace, doesn't it? It doesn't.
But it's one of the reasons I like the Dylan's Chronicles. I think Dylan's Chronicles is based on 1961, 1970, and 1989. Those are the three periods he concentrates on, because he happened to be writing sleeve notes for reissues of those albums. And therefore, you don't get that feeling that it's all over, or you're on the way down, or you know, everything's kind of quietening out and leveling out at the end. And I thought it was quite interesting. I wondered if more people should think about doing memoirs that just end.
That'll be the next
intense excitement.
That will be the next thing for the people who've already written their autobiography, is to just go back and write a book about one of their records.
Yeah.
For 1 year or something like that.
Yeah.
Because there'll be a lot of people who'd be really interested in it.
Yeah.
There's probably endless detail that they could get into.
Yeah.
If they did that. So anyway.
And the other thing I thought with the Richard Thompson, which I think he made a really good point, he's talking about folk rock snobbishness. Didn't you think that was interesting? There's a lovely bit where he's invited. It's very early days of Fairport Convention. He and Sandy Denny are invited to Paul McCartney's birthday party. And they get a handwritten invitation. Paul McCartney's birthday party. And he said he thinks about it. He thinks, well, they're a pop group, aren't they, the Beatles? Pop group, you know, it's all superficial. It's all a bit glib. It's all a bit cheap and cheerful. You know, we're folk music. And he decides not to go. Sandy Denny goes, has an absolutely fantastic time. He refuses to go because he can't lower himself to associate with people in the pop world. I thought that was really interesting. And then he talked about the folk world generally as being people who abided by a kind of egalitarian rule that if anybody had success, if anybody breaks away, it happens to Jerry Rafferty, it happens to Billy Connolly, it happens to various others, you know, then the others are kind of really disapproving. I think they've somehow betrayed folk music. Didn't you think that was interesting? It reminded me of that time. It was so competitive between Fairport Convention, Steel Eyes Band, and Pentangle about who could be the most kind of authentic folk group. Do you remember that? Who's the most real? They were all trying to go back and find the earliest songs. I think Hunting's song, Pentangle did, I think it was something like 16th or 17th century, you know. And then Fairport had set up this whole thing about it being a kind of, you know, an academic exercise in preserving British and English roots music. And Steel Eyes Band, you know, were the ones with the most complicated medieval harmonies and time signatures, you know. And Pentangle went to the point where they didn't even use electric instruments. So it was all acoustic, and we are the purists because we, you know, and had no performance. They didn't perform. Jackie McShee sat down. She was just, her vocal was just another instrument. It wasn't part of some projection. I mean, all that's quite interesting, really. And, you know, how snobbish it all was. We are all snobs, actually, ourselves. I mean, I admit that we all feel that we're above certain things.
Well, popular music is founded on snobbery. It's the key driver. It's not, I like the sound of it. It's, no, I like the idea of it.
Yeah.
That's what people really like about it, you know.
Yeah.
And they've worked out that this bit is superior to this bit.
It's speaking like jazz, of, it's like bebop above all the rest of jazz, you know.
Speaking of which, and falls from grace, I've intrigued to follow the continuing misadventures of Morrissey, who's taking umbrage at the fact that he's been depicted in a Simpsons? Or what?
It's a Simpsons, it's an episode of The Simpsons called Panic on the Streets of Springfield. And he features as a character called Quillaby, voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch. I've not seen this, but I think it sounds quite funny. And I think Lisa has a dream, doesn't she? There's this young, rather depressed British singer from the 1980s who's vegan, and he sports a quiff, and he has an Oscar Wilde poster. And he has songs that include How Late Is Then, Hamburger Homicide, and Everyone Is Horrid Except For Me and Possibly You. So it's fairly obvious who this person is. And then she has this dream, and then the dream is shattered when he morphs into a kind of grey, meat-eating, overweight man with anti-immigrant views. And Morrissey himself, as you know, has sort of taken umbrage. And we obviously, you and I aren't going to get into a very deep conversation about this. We've had our tangles with Morrissey in the past. But you know, he had his wonderful quote saying, "I've had enough horror thrown at me to kill off a herd of bison." Can you imagine mopping his brow, a la kind of
on his fainting couch.
On his chaise longue with his bottle of laudanum conveniently to hand.
Oh, dear.
But no, my theory was that, well, it's not my theory, it's fairly obvious, that I think that there is no, hell hath no fury, like that of a Smiths fan who feels left out.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think I'm prepared to bet that the person who wrote this episode, the people involved, were huge Morrissey fans. And of course, they are. This episode was written by a guy called Tim Long, an American guy. He saw the Queen Is Dead tour and he said it changed his life. Says, though, the character's not just Morrissey, it's also Robert Smith of The Cure and it's Ian Curtis. Like, that's not the point. This is a guy who feels mortally there. And I think it's really interesting because I think, apart from obviously the sex scandals, which is a totally different thing, the Chuck Berry and, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis and Michael Jackson, but yeah, apart from that, can you think of a rock musician whose star has fallen so rapidly as Morrissey's? Because
you see,
people had so much invested in him. The people we know, we're too old.
I come at it the other way because I never had anything invested in Morrissey at all. I don't care about Morrissey at all.
Yeah.
I quite like a few Smiths records. I quite like a few Morrissey. In fact, I very much like a few Morrissey records. But I've never bothered about Morrissey at all. But I've worked with loads of people who are obsessed with Morrissey.
Right, but that's it. We're too
more
old.
Obsessed with Morrissey than you or I were ever obsessed with the Beatles.
Completely.
Or Bob
because
Dylan
the thing
or
about Morrissey was...
utterly obsessed with.
They totally changed their view of the world. Changed the way they thought
they
about everything.
They are umbilically connected to Morrissey.
Yeah.
So everything that goes on in Morrissey's world bothers them like crazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's a part of me that is kind of mischievous admiration of the way that Morrissey has carried on, like he doesn't care about this at all, you know, that we admire traditionally in rock and roll. People venerate the rebel, the person who doesn't care what the rest of the herd wants, you know, who goes their own way.
Yeah.
But boy, people don't like it when somebody really doesn't like the way that doesn't act the way the rest of the herd acts and goes his own way. And he's deliberately done this in the last 10 years. He's obviously said, I don't care if this affects my popularity. This is the way I am. These are the things I think.
Does he not care? Because there are all these kind of, wounded kind of bleating comments. Like here, I mean, he has contacted the world via his manager to say that he's extremely displeased about the way that he's portrayed in this thing. He has never been that overweight. He's never been this, that, and the other, you know. And if he didn't care, he wouldn't have had any response at all. But I take your point. I mean, I'm slightly admiring of the way he just kind of carries on with doing precisely what is not expected of him.
Yeah.
Whether you approve of it or not. But it is interesting. And I can't think of anybody who is more kind of revered, really. As you say, now, I was too old. When the Smiths came along, I was, I don't know how old I was, 28 or something. So I was just, you've got to be 15 to be really in kind of the white heat of these things. But the effect that it had on people, you know, his whole way of looking at the world, his attitudes, the supercharged poetry of his songs, the vegetarian campaigning, everything, the political issues. Yeah, it had an incredible effect. So it's like a divorce. I think these people feel that they were absolutely wedded to him, and now they can't deal with it anymore. Mm. Yeah, there are various musicians who just became kind of whipping posts, you know. Sting and, you know, Phil Collins, people just duffed up by the press the whole time, but not to this extent because nobody held them in that kind of reverence in the first place, really. And I just can't think. Do you remember he was for a while? He was Saint Stephen at the NME. Yeah. They had pictures of him on the cover. He's referred to as Saint Stephen. I can't think of an equivalent, really. It's a long way to fall.
Well, he's you know, he's made his own bed. And he appears happy to lie in it. So, you know, who are we to argue?
Yeah.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So any other business, Alex?
We've got an event, haven't we?
We have got an event on July the 17th. It's been, I think, the previous last live event where we were there in person in the same space was, what was it, March 8th?
March last year.
And we're delighted to announce that on July the 17th this year, we'll be bringing you not a word in your ear, not a word in your attic, but a word in your park, or a word in the park. And the park in question is Holland Park in West London. And we're very delighted to say that through the kind offices of Opera Holland Park and James Clutton, we're able to use their covered auditorium, which they set up every year in front of Holland House in Holland Park. And that'll be on a Saturday afternoon on July the 17th between 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock, where we're going to present 2 hours of what we're calling, what Alan Partridge would undoubtedly call Top Rock Chat, wouldn't he? I suppose he would, wouldn't he?
He would. Rock and roll storytelling.
There you go. With
great folklore revisited.
Yeah, with
the first time.
Guests to be announced in due course. But it should be a good opportunity for people to kind of get together in a socially distanced auditorium, you know, with all COVID protocols fully observed. And we can guarantee it's going to be a lovely day, isn't it? We've ordered that.
We've booked the weather.
We've booked the weather.
Yeah, it cost us, actually, but it's going to be worth it.
July 17th, it's going to be a scorcher. It's going to be gorgeous.
Think rosé, you know.
It's also record shop day, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so there may be some people who are coming into town on that day to buy some records. And so what better way to finish off the second half of the day than to come to Word in Your Park in Holland Park. So how do people get tickets for this, Alex?
By opening their laptop or their phone, device of their choice, and going to wiyelondon.com. There should be a widget on the front page of the website where you can easily get your tickets.
Good. And we'll have further
details. And we'll put the link at the end of this podcast as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll have further details in due course and, you know, who's going to be on the bill and joining us that afternoon in due course. But we hope to see as many of you as possible on what's bound to be pretty special, special occasion in a very special place. We look forward to seeing you there. Meanwhile, usual, if you're not already a Patreon supporter, please consider becoming one. Go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for full details about how you can get involved. What have we got coming up? We've got the usual quiz on Friday nights at 6 o'clock.
Bernie Marsden, I think.
We're doing a crowdcast with Bernie Marsden on Monday evening.
Richard Thompson is going to be out soon.
Yeah, those will be out with you soon. And even more in the pipeline. So, you know, we'll be there if you'll be there.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.